Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today is Richard Brookhiser, a senior editor at the National Review, an author of several books, several of them on our founding fathers. Mr. Brookhiser writes on his website, which, by the way, is richardbrookhiser.com, recounts his work with the National Review and other magazines, then says, along the way, I became a historian of the founding period. After writing about modern politicians, it didn't seem a stretch to write about dead ones. The founders are our fathers. They're also our contemporaries, present in so much of what we think and do. His latest book is a biography of James Madison, who Mr. Brookhiser says is rightly known as the father of the Constitution, but should also be known as the father of politics. And we'll talk about James Madison. We'll review the state of conservative politics, look at the presidential election as well, and much else with Richard Brookhiser today. By the way, this conversation sponsored by the Project on Liberty and American Constitutionalism at Utah State University. Richard Brookhiser, pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with something.
And by the way, I will be coming to Utah. I was supposed to be there today and yesterday. My wife got sick, but the Project on Liberty and American Constitutionalism is going to get me out sometime later this year.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So we'll look forward to that visit. You say about James Madison, and I want to talk about history there, and you say he justly should be known as the father of the Constitution. You say he should also be known as the father of politics, and you talk about the fact that we like to revere our founding fathers, we like to hold up our ideals, we don't like to think much about politics, though.
Well, look, we are right to revere them. I certainly revere them, and I've written half a dozen books now explaining why I do and why we should and in what ways they're worthy of it. But we also have to remember that these men were politicians. The political system they set up is still recognizably the same one we have. Many details have changed, but a lot that goes on has not changed. And one of the most important of the founding fathers in setting up the political system, one of the major players and most thoughtful players, was James Madison, the fourth president.
You write that he lived in his head, but he had a very strong sense, as you write, in a free country, the road to reality runs through politics.
That's right. I mean, Madison was an intellectual. Everybody who knew him knew that about him. He was very often the smartest guy in the room. Without being an arrogant man or a boastful man, that fact would leak out because he was just so well informed. He thought so deeply about whatever it was that was under discussion. But at the same time, he was a political player. He was a political boss. He and Thomas Jefferson set up the first political party in post-constitutional American history, the first national American political party. Now, Madison called it the Republican Party, which was the name it had for 30 years, from the early 1790s on until the 1820s. Then it called itself the Democratic Party, which is the name it still has. So it's the oldest political party in the world, except for the Tories in England. And James Madison and Thomas Jefferson set that party up.
So he was instrumental in setting up the first party, also the first party publication, right? The first, as you say it, the first, you call him a boss, right? The first political machine.
Well, right. The two other things he did, along with setting up a party, I mean, once you have a party, one thing you have to do is publicize its beliefs. So it's helpful to have partisan media. Now, the United States had a very lively media culture all through the colonial and revolutionary period. lots of newspapers, lots of pamphlets, and a lot of these were filled with political information and controversy. But Madison's innovation in the early 1790s, we're talking about the George Washington administration, is to set up a newspaper in the nation's capital, which was then Philadelphia. It was called the National Gazette, and this was to be a partisan newspaper supporting the brand new Republican Party of Madison and Jefferson. Madison found the first editor for it. It was an old college friend of his from Princeton, a man named Philip Freneau. He got him a no-show job at the State Department, where Jefferson was Secretary of State. That guaranteed him a salary, but they all knew that what he would mostly be doing is editing this newspaper. And so National Review and the New Republic and The Nation and Fox and MSNBC, they are all descendants of the National Gazette, which Madison set up in the 1790s. The other thing you mentioned, Madison being a political boss, one of the first American political machines became known as the Virginia Dynasty, and this is the succession in the White House of the third, fourth, and fifth presidents. Thomas Jefferson, president from 1800 to 1808, two terms, followed by his best friend, James Madison, president from 1808 to 1816, followed by a third friend, James Monroe, president for eight more years. So for 24 years, you've got three Virginians from the same state, members of the same party, the first Republican Party, and friends and neighbors of each other. You know, without having a literal royal family with descent by blood, that's about the closest you can get in a Republican political system.
Hmm. We're talking with Richard Brookhiser on the program today. He's a senior editor at the National Review, author of several books on our founding fathers, the latest of which is James Madison. Mr. Brookhiser said he is justly known as the father of the Constitution, also should be known as the father of politics. I want to get into and make some contrast to today as well. You in the introduction talk about when Dolly Madison met her, who would become her husband. She told a friend that the great little Madison, that's how she called him, had asked to see me this evening. And then you go on to make this contrast. He was a mighty figure and a little guy. And that contrast, you say, has a moral dimension, too.
Well, right. I mean, physically, he's a little bit over 5 feet. I mean, they insist at Montpelier, which is his home in Virginia, they say he was 5'6". I'm not so sure about that. He was a short guy. He was a slight guy, physically. But, of course, as we've been saying, he was this influential figure and with this great mind. But the metaphor I was trying to make of that is that he is both an intellectual. He's both a source of a lot of our constitutional thought and a lot of the work that went into the Constitution, but he's also the party leader and the hardball player and the political guy. And he's in the trenches, and he's in there fighting from the first Washington administration right through John Adams's and Thomas Jefferson's and his own. Mm-hmm. So this is 30 years of political combat at the national level in which he is a major player. And I should say that if the Founding Fathers came back now, you know, and if they turned on the television now and they watched the Obama-Romney contest, and this question comes up to me a lot, not just in this cycle but in previous ones, what would they think of our politics now? And the answer I always give is that they would say, congratulations, you've really cleaned it up. There's less lying. There's less craziness. It's not so frantic. It's not so frenzied. You've really calmed the whole thing down. And, you know, and this can shock people because, after all, these are our founding fathers. They're on the money. They're on Mount Rushmore. We revere them, and we should. But the politics of the 1790s, right up through the War of 1812, this 25 years of our first two-party system, the Republicans of Madison and Jefferson versus the Federalist Party of Washington, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, That party system was about the craziest we have ever had in American history. The level of vituperation is really jaw-dropping.
In fact, you write about, you know, that Madison, though being a great intellectual, was very good at the, what you might call the, you know, the thrust and parry of politics. He employed hatchet men. There were spies. He wasn't averse to a mob or two.
Well, one of his errand boys was a man named John Beckley, who became the clerk of the House of Representatives. And what Beckley did for Madison and Jefferson, Beckley had been a journalist. He knew all the printers in Philadelphia, which was then the nation's capital. So he knew, and as clerk of the House, he knew the handwritings of politicians. So when essays were printed in the Philadelphia newspapers, he also knows all the printers in town. Just by looking at a manuscript, he can tell from the handwriting who has written this. Now, essays then were done under pseudonyms. The Federalist Papers, for instance, were all signed Publius, although they were written by Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. They all used a common pseudonym, Publius, and everybody did that. No one used his real name. It was just the custom. But Beckley could figure out who wrote what, and he would pass this information on to Madison and Jefferson. Beckley also was a great rumor monger. He always had his ear to the ground. So he would be telling his patrons, Jefferson and Madison, who was invested in government securities, who in Congress had investments in the debt of the United States, and did this affect the votes they cast on Alexander Hamilton's financial program? Did they stand to benefit from its being passed? And if you could draw a connection, if you could look at what their investments were, then you could say, oh, well, you know, they're self-interested, aren't they? So Beckley is the great gossip and errand boy that Madison and Jefferson are using. Now, obviously, they're not going to do this stuff themselves. They're not going to, you know, show up at some newspaper office and ask the printer, to look at the manuscript and pore over the handwriting and say, oh, yes, that must be by Hamilton. They're not going to do that. They're gentlemen. But a party is composed of more than gentlemen. It has to have all sorts in it to make it effective, and Madison figured this out very early on.
So bringing this to today, you say the Founding Fathers would say, congratulations, you've brought much more civility to the process. And yet, I think over the stretch, and you write that the politics embarrass us, this back and forth. I wonder about, you know, it still does today depress a lot of people, the state of our politics today.
Well, you know, it does, but aren't we a little hypocritical about that? I mean, what we're really depressed by is what the people we don't like do. You know, if we're Republican, we're depressed by what the Democrats do, and vice versa. If we're Democrats, we're depressed by what the Republicans do. But we want our guys to be out there doing it. I mean, if we think something is important to us, we hope that it will happen. You know, we hope that the right legislation gets passed, and we want people to push for that. We want people to argue for that and to make the case for that. Now, when our rivals are doing that, we call that influence peddling or pandering in the media or whatever. But it's really just the same thing seen backwards in a mirror.
It does seem like people are hearkening back to a few decades ago when the debate and the work across the aisle seemed to be more collegial and productive.
Well, look, it comes and goes. I'm sure there are cycles, but the parties know that each one, its advantage is in prevailing over the other. And, elections are zero-sum games. We have head-to-head elections, so only one person can win in any one contest. And since we have a two-party system, even though it's not in the Constitution, never mentioned in the Constitution, no mention of parties, much less two parties. But Only a few years after the Constitution was ratified, lo and behold, two parties spring up. And that's been the dynamic throughout most of American politics. So the parties, they know which side their bread is buttered, and they go at it. And they've been doing this for over 200 years now.
Mm. Now, some at the very founding, this is the conventional wisdom on Washington, anyway, I don't know if it's accurate, didn't want parties, hope we wouldn't have parties.
None of them wanted parties. Mm. None of them wanted parties at first. Washington said so. You can find quotes from Thomas Jefferson saying so, from John Adams. They all had this notion that, you know, once we have won the revolution against Britain, and now we have reformed our government, we have a constitution, and we've even satisfied the opponents of the constitution by adding a Bill of Rights to it. So America is all on the same page, and we won't have to have contention, and won't that be great? Well, all right, that's the hope, that's the perhaps the theory, but almost immediately, contention arises, disputes arise. In their time, it was over Alexander Hamilton's financial program, and it was over foreign affairs. There was a French Revolution months after Washington's first inauguration. He's inaugurated in April 1789. The Bastille falls in July 1789. So we have a French Revolution, and then we have a world war set off by the French Revolution, which goes right through the lifetime of Napoleon, and it doesn't end till Waterloo. 25 years of international conflict. What should the United States do? Should we tilt to Britain? Should we tilt to France? And these become partisan issues, and they become bones of contention, and then they become partisan issues. So whatever the theory they had in 1789, by 1791, 92, and on since, right up till today, we actually have had parties.
We're talking with Richard Brookhiser, a senior editor at the National Review and author of several books on our founding fathers. Latest is James Madison. And we're talking about James Madison, bringing that forward to today. We'll continue this discussion after this brief break.
Utah Public Radio now makes it even easier to stay up to date with News at Noon on Twitter. This is April Ashland, UPR's social media coordinator, inviting you to follow and join the conversation about politics, local, and statewide events by going to twitter.com/Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Richard Brookhiser for the hour today, a senior editor with the National Review. He's written for many other publications and written many books, several of them on our founding fathers. The latest is a biography of James Madison. Richard Brookhiser says he's justly known as the founder of the Constitution, should also be known as founder of politics. We're talking about that dichotomy today and bringing it forward to today's political scene. And you're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. Richard Brookhiser was set for an appearance at Utah State University, sponsored by the Project on Liberty and American Constitutionalism at Utah State University, and that appearance will be rescheduled. So, Mr. Brookhiser, maybe you could tell me a little bit. I'd like to paint a picture of James Madison. He's short, he's slight, powerful intellect. And one thing about him, for a man in the political arena, and knew he had to be there, he had a problematic speaking style.
Well, yes, he's no Patrick Henry, right? Many times when he's engaged in debate in public forums, such as the Virginia Ratifying Convention, the note takers who are recording what everybody says, they'll record a few paragraphs of him, and then they'll say the rest of Mr. Madison's remarks could not be heard because he spoke too low. So his voice was a little soft. It was also apparently unpleasant. One person compared it to a croak. But the way he was effective or could be effective in public speaking was by his mastery of detail. And the Virginia Ratifying Convention is an interesting case of that. This is to decide whether or not the state of Virginia will ratify the Constitution. All the states have to make this decision, and if 9 ratify, the Constitution will go into effect. 9 out of the 13 will make the Constitution real. And Virginia is the 9th that is still undecided by the summer of 1788. So this is a crucial fight in Madison's home state. And it's also crucial because Virginia is the largest state in the nation. It's the largest in terms of size, largest population, also the most eminent state. This is the home of George Washington. If Virginia doesn't ratify, the Constitution really is not going to work, even if it gets 9 other states. So that's the setting. And the fight is between Madison leading the pro-Constitution forces and Patrick Henry leading the anti-Constitution forces. And Henry is doing this partly out of political opportunism, because he sees there's a lot of resistance to the Constitution in Virginia, but also out of conviction. He is afraid that the new Constitution strengthens the government of the United States too much at the expense of the individual states. And Henry reels variation after variation off on this. He actually speaks one quarter of the time of the whole ratifying convention. One quarter of the words that are uttered of all the delegates are uttered by Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry is the greatest orator in the country at that moment. I mean, this is the man who said, "Give me liberty, give me death." That's the heights he could reach. So if you're James Madison and you're a little guy and you've got a weak, unpleasant voice, how do you beat this man? I mean, you can't go head-to-head with him. You know, you can't do the same thing back. It's just, you know, that no way. So what Madison does instead is he keeps to the topic at hand, he keeps to the details. And every time Henry goes off on some aria, like an opera singer, you know, Madison is always there to say, but right now we're discussing Article 2, Section 2, which says blah, 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 and here's why it says it, and this is why it was done this way. And he just brings it back to the topic at hand. And then the climax of this, I mean, this was great. The last day of the ratifying convention, Henry can feel that things are slipping away from him. And he says, aerial beings are watching us. Spirits in the air. Aerial beings are watching us. You know, and I fear that if we, you know, if we pass this Constitution, they foresee bad things. And then as soon as he finishes, a storm hits. You know, a storm suddenly hits the building where they're meeting. And all the shutters on the windows and the doors, they go bang, they slap to, and everybody runs out of the room. You know, it's like the aerial beings have struck. So that's what Madison is up against. But he manages to win because of his detail work.
He had at least one debate with, I think this was with James Monroe.
James Monroe, yes.
In the outdoors, he got frostbite?
Yes. Well, now this was, okay, the Constitution is ratified. So now every state has to elect 2 senators and however many representatives it's been allotted. So Patrick Henry is still very powerful in Virginia politics. He gets the state legislature to draw the congressional districts for the state of Virginia. He passes a law saying that you must reside in the district that you seek to represent. Now, actually, this is unconstitutional. The Constitution does not require representatives to reside in the district where they represent, but it's not going to be challenged and overturned for a number of years. So that's the law under which this first election is occurring. And then the district he draws for James Madison, where Madison's home is at Montpelier in Orange County, he draws this hatchet-shaped district, kind of oddly shaped district, and he tries to sweep into it as many counties as possible that oppose the Constitution, including the home county of James Monroe. Now, I said earlier that Monroe was part of the Virginia dynasty along with Jefferson and that they were friends and neighbors, and that's true. But Monroe and Madison do have their clashes over the years occasionally. I mean, there's a certain rivalry of ambition. Madison is slightly older, but Monroe wants to leave his own mark, you know. So there's kind of some overcrowding within the state of Virginia. So these two men, mostly friends, but now they're running against each other. And so they have a number of debates. One of the issues is a lack of a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. And the religious minorities in Virginia are very alarmed about this, particularly the Baptists. Virginia was an Anglican state, an Anglican colony. Now it's a majority Episcopalian state. The Baptists were very badly treated in the colonial period by the Anglican establishment. They sure as hell want a Bill of Rights to protect their religious liberties, and the Constitution doesn't yet have one, and this is an issue that Monroe makes. So Madison and Monroe have to duke it out. And as you said, one of their confrontations is at a church of another religious minority, the Lutherans in Virginia. And after the church service, the two candidates go out onto the church porch to debate each other. Now, this election is being held in the early spring, even before spring. It's February. So they're out there in February, and it's lousy weather. It is snowing. And they debate, but it's so cold out there that when Madison rides home to Montpelier, by the time he gets there, his nose is frostbitten. And you can see little marks, which are the remains of that, for the rest of his life. But once again, he beats Monroe. And in this confrontation, the reason he beats him on this issue of religious liberty is, even though there is not yet a Bill of Rights on the Constitution, the Baptists in Virginia know that Madison has been their friend for many years. He stuck up for them when Virginia was still a colony just before the Revolution. He did it all through the Revolutionary period. He was the friend of free exercise of religion in Virginia. He worked with Thomas Jefferson to make that the law of the state of Virginia. So the Baptists have reached out to him, and they have said, we are concerned that there is no Bill of Rights in this new document, and Madison has assured them that if he gets into Congress, he will make that top priority to add it to the Constitution by amendment. And they trust him, because he's been their friend for years. So that is how he is able to win this confrontation with his on-again, off-again friend, James Monroe.
We're talking with Richard Brookhiser on the program today. He is a senior editor at the National Review, author of many books, several of them on the Founding Fathers. Also, you may have seen programs on PBS that he wrote and hosted, Rediscovering George Washington and Rediscovering Alexander Hamilton. He was to have come to Utah State University for the Project on Liberty and American Constitutionalism at Utah State University. That visit will be rescheduled. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our email is upraxcess@gmail.com, or the number is 1-800-826-1495. So Madison is tenacious, very energetic, is very good at not only the intellectual side of politics with the Thurston Perry. Another fact about him, he was a hypochondriac.
Yes, he was, and this is... You know, you feel very sympathetic. I mean, I did, writing about this. I mean, this poor guy, he's sickly all his life. He worries about it. It preys upon him. You know, when he has to make trips, when he's going from, say, Montpelier to Philadelphia, you go in a stagecoach. It's a public conveyance. And if you have... You know, gastrointestinal problems, you got to ask the stagecoach to stop, you know, so you can relieve yourself. How humiliating. Now, okay, it's the 18th century. People are probably used to it. But still, who wants to be in that situation? And poor Madison finds himself in that situation whenever he has to travel along a long distance. But I have to say, like many hypochondriacs, he does manage to live until he's 85 years old. So sickly he may have been, but it didn't kill him until he was a ripe old age.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about Dolly. She's instrumental, isn't she? And it seems that she's better at some of these things than he is.
She completes his personality as a politician. Now, I think they were also devoted to each other. And it was a good marriage. But let's talk about the public aspects of it. They get married when Madison is middle-aged, and she's already a widow. She was married. Her husband died in a yellow fever epidemic, and she has a surviving son who becomes Madison's stepson. But the thing about Dolly, what she adds to James... James is actually, among friends, a very good storyteller. He's a funny guy. His conversation is delightful. People really enjoy it. But if there's one stranger in the room, he just clams up. One stranger, he can't do his friendly thing. He is just, there is a certain barrier of shyness. He shuts down. So Dolly, by contrast, is an extrovert. She's attractive. She's warm. She's a little sexy, also a little maternal as she ages. You know, she sort of plays both at the same time. And she's a great hostess. She likes throwing parties. During the Jefferson administration, because President Jefferson is a widower, Mrs. Madison, Dolly, the wife of the Secretary of State, in effect becomes the hostess for the administration in Washington. And then when her husband, James, becomes president, she is the First Lady and the hostess in the White House. And she loves this. She's great at it. There's a wonderful moment where she's greeting Henry Clay, who is a young rising star of Congress, and Clay comes up to her and says, "Everybody loves Mrs. Madison." And she comes right back. She says, "That's because Mrs. Madison loves everybody." Now, you know, this is two Virginians air kissing each other. I mean, Clay was living in Kentucky, but he'd been born in Virginia. It's, you know, it's a Southern thing, but she means it. I mean, she really would rather like you than dislike you. And this is a great help to her husband, because in those days, parties did not yet have political conventions. That's an innovation of the 1830s. So in 1808 and 1812, when Madison makes his runs for president, presidential candidates are picked by a different, earlier system, which is called the caucus. And the caucus system was simply everybody in Congress belonging to a particular party would get together and meet, all the senators, all the congressmen, and they would pick the candidate for that party for the upcoming election. So when Dolly Madison is throwing parties in Washington, they're not just social functions. The people who are the guests at her parties are the guys who are going to pick the presidential nominee. So these are also lobbying sessions and, you know, stroking sessions and, you know, making sure your friends are still your friends. And she's great at it.
I'm thinking about, you know, some of these could have been handicaps for James Madison, just tenaciousness and other skills saw him through, and fortunate to marry Dolly in that case. I'm thinking, bringing it forward to maybe the last few decades, You can be successful in politics even if you were not a natural. I think, you know, some people are naturals like Bill Clinton, but for example, Richard Nixon, not a natural. You can be successful by other means.
Well, you know, interesting comparison because Nixon was also very tenacious. I mean, really like the Energizer Bunny. He never quit, and Nixon was also very smart. I mean, you know, I won't say he was as smart as James Madison, but Nixon was a very intelligent man, and I think people picked that up. That was part of his persona as a politician, certainly by 1968. And so those are aspects in which he resembled Madison, someone who was, you know, maybe not so prepossessing physically, but appeared to have other strengths.
I want to bring maybe forward to today. We talked about some debates that James Madison was involved in, even though he, you know, had some handicaps there, but won some important debates. Debates, and we've just had a big presidential debate. Do you think debates nowadays, the big televised debates, many people tune in? Do you think the format allows for us to get what we need from those debates?
Well, you know, and this is one of the things that's changed in American politics. When James Madison was running for president, you didn't campaign. I mean, to run for that office, you weren't supposed to run. You stood for office. You had your friends, you know, beating the drums for you. And you had journalists, you know, taking your side and publishing newspapers in your favor and so on. But, you know, people did not even start running for president until many decades later. But so what do the debates give us? I think we tend to exaggerate their effects. You know, we remember that Reagan beat Carter in the debate they had when Reagan said, there you go again. Well, I saw that debate, and it was really pretty close. You know, Reagan did not mop the floor with Carter. Carter was a smart guy, and he was a good debater, and it was kind of an even contest. But there was that one moment, that one comment, and that crystallized certain feelings in the voters, and I think helped, really did help in the home stretch, tilt the election to Reagan. Similarly with the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960, which I don't remember, but which, you know, you can watch them on YouTube and certainly read about them. So, you know, commentators, people like me, we tend to exaggerate perhaps the effect that a debate has, but at the same time, I think they can have an effect, and what they can do is allow feelings that are potential or that have been building to reach a certain critical mass. And if there was, say, a dissatisfaction with an incumbent, as there was with Carter, then, well, you can't beat somebody with nobody. You have to have an alternative who seems attractive. And I think that's what Reagan did in his debate with Carter. He showed up. He wasn't a demon. He didn't have horns. He wasn't a fanatic. He wasn't an extremist. And then he showed that bit of humor and self-confidence. And then that gave enough people who were on the fence a reason to think, okay, let's try this guy. We know that the incumbent has not pleased us. I mean, the economy's in the tank, foreign policy's a mess. So, all right, here's Ronald Reagan. We see now that he's plausible, so let's give him a shot. And I think that's what people have been saying about the first Obama-Romney debate. Now, we've got two more to go, and we've still got a month before Election Day, and I have to say, in the home stretch of a modern campaign, a month is eternity. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot can happen in a month, and we'll see. But that's the reaction people have had to the debate last week.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that might be playing out, but we've got a long way to go with the
months. Yes, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder what you think about Governor Romney. Does he fit into mainstream conservatism?
Oh, yes, I think so. And I think he showed that during the Republican primaries, and which I think served him well, by the way. It really prepped him for presidential debates, because he had to go through this mill. How many debates were there? It was like 20 of them. I mean, it was just an endless process, but that gets you in shape. You know, it's like spring training. And he was attacked. I mean, they all went after him. Michelle Bachmann and Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry and Rick Santorum and Herman Cain and a lot of their criticism, a lot of the criticism that these people made in different ways was, well, Romney, he's not a real conservative, or you can't trust him. He was governor of Massachusetts, you know, liberal state. He had to be, you know, he had to be out of the mainstream of the party to win that office. And now he says he's more right wing than he really is, and you know, you can't trust him. Well, and I think what Romney was able to do over the course of all those debates was satisfy enough Republicans that, well, yes, we can trust him, and he seems like a good Republican to us, and so Romney won what he had to win to get the nomination. One interesting thing about him is that he's the son of another presidential candidate, George Romney. His father ran for the Republican nomination in the 68 cycle. And he was the front runner for a while, and then he said he'd been to Vietnam, and that the generals there had the American generals and briefers had brainwashed him, and then that comment sunk him. I mean, he was trying to say they were feeding him a line of success that wasn't true. Maybe he was right about that, but by using the word brainwashing, people didn't like that. That sunk him. But that is also a very old pattern in American politics, the family quality of certain candidates. And Romney is not the first. Obviously, George W. Bush was the son of George H.W. Bush. We all know about the Kennedy family, and a Kennedy just won a nomination for a congressional seat again in Massachusetts, so they're still marching on. And the first literal family was the Adamses. You know, our second president was John Adams, and our sixth president was John Quincy Adams, who was John's eldest son. So the disposition to reach for a family man is a very old one in American politics.
Mm. I wonder what you feel about the state of the conservative movement nowadays. We seem to have had, the whole Tea Party movement. There seems to be a resurgence of libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
But the mainstream conservative movement, maybe as espoused in the National Review over the years, is it healthy?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, look, 4 years ago, we were all in the dumps. You know, people were writing our obituaries, including some of us. Obama beats McCain solidly, and he's this historic figure. He, obviously, the first African-American president, a huge breakthrough, something that even his opponents saw as a good thing. I mean, we didn't agree with any of his policies, but you know, all right, that milestone has been passed. Good. But we came back. We bounced back, and I think this is one advantage that Americans now have over the founders, and this gets back to one of the first points I made, which was the frenzy of politics in the founding generation. One reason they were so frantic and so vituperative, and this was not just the lower down mudslingers. This went all the way to the top. Thomas Jefferson believed that Alexander Hamilton was a secret monarchist and a British agent. Alexander Hamilton believed that if Jefferson won, he might set up guillotines. Or at least in one letter he wrote that. I think he cooled off later on, but there's one letter where he's writing a friend and saying, well, the stakes in this election are liberty, property, order, and of course heads. You know, he just tosses that off at the end. Heads, like the other party will set up guillotines. And why did people think that? I mean, why did these great men think that? These are not like commenters on blogs. You know, these were the founders thinking that. Well, they thought it because it was all brand new. And it was so new, they were filled with anxiety. You know, and what would happen if the other party got in or stayed in? Will these guys hang on forever? You know, and now we understand that there are cycles in politics. You know, that if you lose, you're going to have another shot in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. You know, maybe you'll lose then as well, but then you'll still have another shot. And at some point, the wheel is going to turn. And I think people in politics, certainly, they understand that. They've internalized it. And even though they get their game face on and they're out there slinging mud and, you know, doing dirty tricks and all the rest of it, still they know that the other guys are not monarchists and secret agents of foreign powers, and that they're not going to set up guillotines. They're not going to kill you. And that is something that we have learned, and only time could teach it. But I think America has learned it.
So you're saying that this is game face. People and at their heart know, you know, obviously we know their cycles. It does seem to be, at least in the public, a lot of hand-wringing on both sides when the other party wins. For example, President Obama is both a communist and a Nazi, you know, and there were very vicious things said about George W. Bush, you know.
But who's saying that? I mean, that's being said by you know, like people foaming at the mouth on the Internet. It's not being said by Mitt Romney, you know, and Obama is not saying that Romney, you know, wears magic underwear and you know, whatever. I mean, you fill in the blanks. So, sure, I mean, people lower down go off half-cocked, but the politicians themselves, they know the score. You know, and another one symbol of this difference between now and the founding period is that our politicians now do not actually kill each other, which did happen. I mean, Alexander Hamilton is killed by the Vice President of the United States in a duel. And that had its origin in their political rivalry, Hamilton versus Aaron Burr. And Hamilton is not the only signer of the Constitution who was killed in a duel. There was another man, Richard Speight from North Carolina. He was killed in a duel by a political rival. Thomas Jefferson put a duelist on the Supreme Court. A man named Brockholst Livingston became an associate justice of the Supreme Court, and he'd killed someone in a duel back in New York, which is where he was from. And this, even though duels are illegal everywhere, and deaths in duels are considered murders under every state law, but they're never prosecuted because that's how gentlemen settled questions of honor. And so that was the level of politics in the founding period, really right up through the War of 1812. It could get lethal. It could get literally lethal. And we don't do that anymore.
We just finally just have about a minute left in the program. I wanted to get this email in from Steve. He says, Richard Nixon is not the only recent president who was not a natural. According to Maureen Dowd's column in today's New York Times, neither is Barack Obama.
Well, I read that column, and I understand what she means. There's a certain cerebral quality. We wouldn't have said that in 2008 when he, cleaned everybody's clock. So, people have cycles in their own political performance.
We have spent the hour with Richard Brookhiser, a senior editor at the National Review and author of several books, many of them on our founding fathers. The latest is a biography of James Madison. And Richard Brookhiser was to have come to Utah State University this week for the Project on Liberty and American Constitutionalism at Utah State University. That visit, by the way, will be rescheduled. Richard Brookhiser, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.